Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. The United States is in a cultural crisis. Our young are experiencing unprecedented levels of mental illness. Family structures are crumbling, with both out-of-wedlock births increasing, while the number of children being born is decreasing. Some worry about masculinity under attack, while others believe that toxic masculinity is the cause of most problems. Many are even worried that democracy itself is in real and present danger. It's all a big mess. How do we restore societal equilibrium? In a new compendium of his many columns on cultural issues, What Really Matters, Timothy S. Gagelein offers readers what he calls a blueprint to encourage us to, quote, reevaluate the road we currently travel and get back to the basics of, quote, faith, freedom, and family, institutions upon which this nation was built. Gagelein has spent a career in public service and the nonprofit sector. He is a prolific speaker and public intellectual. He worked as a special assistant to President George W. Bush for 8 years at the White House and currently serves as the Vice President for External and Government Relations at Focus on the Family in Washington, D.C. Is the author or co-author of 4 previous books, including Toward a More Perfect Union and Stumbling Toward Utopia. This is his 3rd appearance on this podcast. Tim, welcome back to Humanize.
It is great to be with you, Wesley. Thank you so much. It's always a great honor.
You know, you spent an entire career in public service and policy advocacy, mostly advocating on behalf of the place of faith in the public square. Why has that been such an intense focus of your energies?
Well, you know, I was born and raised in a home where the faith was very foundational, and the way that I grew up, involvement in our community, involvement in our church. I could go on and on. It's very personal in the way that I was born and raised. And I went forward, you know, to a very aggressively secular public university, Indiana University. And even though I had been educated in public schools in Fort Wayne, Indiana, my hometown, I never really experienced enormous challenges to my faith or to my worldview. But when I got to Indiana University, for the very first time in a substantial way, and I look back and really praise God for what I'm about to share, I was really challenged. I mean, from the very beginning, on the most important things that really comprise what I consider to be foundational to the book we're about to discuss, What Really Matters. It was the first time in a sustained way that I personally witnessed a sustained attack on the natural family. The first time that there was a real, I would almost say, sort of liberation in the discussions and debates that I would engage in as an undergraduate on the issue of human life, marriage, family, parenting, the things that I really revered even as a young person, as I say, in a substantial way for the first time, were really challenged. And it congealed in a way that I could not have imagined at the time that would flower into really a lifetime, you know, in public service and in the public square.
Don't you think that it's actually healthy for people to be challenged of their basic beliefs when they are approaching adulthood? I wish it went the other way as well.
Absolutely do. And in fact, I was giving a book talk very recently, and afterward, I was having a wonderful discussion with three young people who are getting ready to go to college. One of them is going to a well-known liberal arts Christian school, and two others are going to the opposite. One is going to a very well-known elite private school that at one time had Christological tenets, but long past, and the other to a very large elite public university. And the four of us were having a discussion about, you know, what to anticipate. And I actually said that in my own experience, that I was actually grateful, Wesley, that I actually went into a large public university that was aggressively secular, because in many ways, it began to force me in a good way to really examine what do I believe, why do I believe it, and also, and I think most importantly, to be able to voice and articulate a defense of the things that matter most. And I've tried to build, I pray, a vocation and a profession consistent with magnanimity and grace and civility, even as I found in multiple times in my own life where I've been most often heatedly challenged on the things that are most important to me.
And the book we're talking about is What Really Matters, Restoring a Legacy of Faith, Freedom, and Family. It's a compendium of Tim's many, many columns over the years. Why did you feel the need to collect your columns into one place?
You know, I, as you mentioned earlier, Wesley, loved writing Stumbling Toward Utopia, because it was a deep dive, really search for where did the social and moral revolution of the 1960s and 70s come from. And I was born in 1964, and I realized several years ago that the phrase, the moral revolution, the sexual revolution, the tsunami of the 60s, that had become almost a part of my own rhetoric. But I thought to myself, do I really know where the 60s came from? And I learned that, in fact, the 60s were not born in the 60s. The 60s, in the way that we think of it, the revolution in education, in politics, in matters of theology, major legal issues, etc., really born at the turn of the 20th century with some very revolutionary ideas relative to the American experience. But what I, and this is maybe my first confession of the day, but what I realized that I did not do in that book is I felt that for all, and I recommend, I pray Stumbling Toward Utopia to people who are listening to us. I think it holds up. But what I did not do is I did not demonstrate those, what I consider to be revolutionary, mostly bad ideas, how they directly impacted many of the institutions that I was writing about. In other words, how did the moral and social revolution by 21st century America, how did those ideas impact marriage, family, parenting, human life, religious liberty, conscience rights, parental rights, pronouns, and so I wanted to integrate the columns and the essays that I write for five well-known places. I wanted to integrate them, synthesize them into some issue areas, and try to be a little bit more systematic based on great empirical data and research to not just make a rhetorical case for these institutions, but to show why empirically they hold up. That there's a great defense for marriage, family, and parenting and human life and the other things I've mentioned, even apart necessarily from the kind of historic Judeo-Christian perspective.
If anybody's interested in Stumbling Toward Utopia, there's a link in the program notes. Also, my interview with Tim on that book will also be in the program notes. So, you come from a very explicitly traditional Christian perspective. Does this book have benefit for people who might not share your Christian faith?
The answer is absolutely yes. And I'd like to kind of demonstrate why that is, if I may. What I decided to do, as you know, in What Really Matters, is I decided, as I mentioned a moment ago, not only to go to the best sociology, the best empirical data sets, the best surveys in support of the institutions we're talking about, but I decided to go actually to the best empirical research of people who in their real lives do not necessarily come from my own faith background or even a political perspective. One of the women whose work I really admire is Melissa Kearney of the University of Maryland. And I think, Wesley, she has actually produced in the last 10 years the best single defense of why two-parent families are best for kids. She is an MIT-trained economist. She's a person of the left. She does not begin with a kind of focus on the family, you know, kind of worldview. But this is a remarkable book. And in fact, I think I have recommended her book probably more, in my own life in the last few years than to any other single book. She concludes where Focus on the Family concludes, which is that two-parent families provide, I'm quoting her, by the way, two-parent families provide significant benefits for children. She says, you know, while single parents work incredibly hard, of course they do. And we should champion the remarkable energy that single parents, but on average, she says, and this is what's so crucial, she says, on average, children from two-parent households have greater access to resources and opportunities. Now, many people may say, that seems to be obvious, isn't it? The answer is, it is not obvious. In fact, I would say overwhelmingly, it is not obvious. And in this wonderful book of hers, over and again, Wesley, as you know, she beautifully demonstrates why two-parent families are really good for the rising generation of young Americans. And I really salute her research.
I think the problem, with discussing those issues is that when you say something like that, people think, well, you're making a moral attack on those who do not have a traditional two-parent household. But her book doesn't do that, is what you're saying. And the question is, are you doing that?
Yeah, I'm actually really honored you asked me. The answer is she does not do it, and I do not do it. And I would like, if I may, to demonstrate again, because there you have Melissa at the University of Maryland, a really excellent scholar and a really solid book. And then over here, I'll say center right, if I may, is my friend Brad Wilcox at the University of Virginia. You know, a very fundamentally different worldview, doing incredibly important sociology. There's the UVA and there's the University of Maryland. Two remarkable scholars, two remarkable academics, two remarkable people, by the way, who care about the things that we care about. And Brad Wilcox, after a lifetime of incredible research, has come to the conclusion that marital quality is far and away the top predictor that he has run across for life satisfaction in all of the empirical research that he's found. And the thing is, as you know, Wesley, what I demonstrate in What Really Matters, I don't just assert this, I demonstrate it, that whether you are a person of the left or the right, if you're looking at the same empirical data sets, or if you're doing original research into the questions that we're talking about, ultimately, you come down pretty much on the same side. And there are variances. And by the way, I write about the variances. I'm comfortable with the fact that it's not just this or this when we're talking about something as big and important as families and kids and etc. One last thing, if I may. You know, I have really been deeply, deeply impacted in my life by the work of both Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who obviously became a very famous U.S. senator, but also was a very important academic and scholar on the issues we're talking about, and also his great friend, both now deceased, Jim Wilson, James Q. Wilson. You know, when you look at the research that they were doing in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and the early 2000s, you're really taken by the fact that in many ways, they were small p prophetic about many of the things we're talking about. I was taken with Jim Wilson's conclusion many, many decades ago, where he said it's not money, but the family that is the foundation of public life. And he said, as it has become weaker, every structure upon that foundation has become weaker. This was not Jim's opinion. When you read Jim's research and the research of others who impacted his own scholarly work, you realize he was quite literally right on the money.
And let's get to some particulars. You start with marriage and you claim that it offers benefits that no other institution can replicate. What are the benefits that you think are unique in a marriage?
Well, I'd like to start, if I may, just where you start, but I want to start by sharing something that I think kind of animates this part of our discussion. Because in my first chapter on restoring marriage, as you know, Wesley, what I share is that fewer than half of U.S. households are now comprised of married couples. And, you know, this is a very significant shift of not, by the way, not from 100 years ago, but from just 50 years ago. I mean, if you and I were having this wonderful discussion 50 years ago, I would have said to you that of all American households, nearly two-thirds, about 65, 66% are comprised of married couples. I mean, that is a very, very dramatic drop. And it seems to me that to be very specific in your question, when you look at the data sets of single Americans, for instance, in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and you look at data sets of married couples in their 20s, 30s, 40s. And by the way, we have a lot of empirical data. America, praise God, is a very rich resource in the multiple ways we can get accurate data. And as you know, multiple times in my book, I compare these data sets of married couples over against people who are single or having been married and divorced. And you can run the tables, as it were, for physical health, mental and emotional health, material health, cultural health, education, the kind of moral ecology broadly defined if these couples have children. And as I say, in every single data set, it is people who are married and very often married with children who and it really is not even close, who do very well in all of these comparisons. So it's really, you're on firm ground when you say that married Americans, overwhelmingly can say that marriage is better for your physical health, better for your mental and emotional health, better for your financial health, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very interesting thing. And I think it's the sort of thing that I'm not just interested in writing about, but I think it's important that the political class be willing to step up and get the word out that marriage is good for Americans.
It's interesting. You know, I was reflecting back as you were speaking on my childhood, and there was this kid in the neighborhood, a good friend, but he was stronger than me and would kind of bully me a little. And he was the only person I knew who was part of a broken home. And my retort would be, ha, 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 you have a stepfather. And I'm ashamed of that now, but, you know, kids are kids. But that the fact that that cut him shows you that back in the day, we're
yes,
talking about the late 50s, let's say, or early 60s, that kind of a taunt from me could cut him to the quick because it was so unusual.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up on that, if I may. As you know, in the book, I want to balance sobering news with good news or hopeful news because I think there's plenty of both. I want to be upfront about that. But I also want to write about and say something that I think is particularly important for this podcast, which is that when you write about and deal with the kind of empirical data, Wesley, that you and I are discussing today, and I know who I'm discussing this with, a very, very important journalist, writer, and public intellectual. One of the things you have to become comfortable with at some level is seeming disjunction and abstraction. And I want to give it a good example of that, because the sobering news in the space of marriage is that a very recent study, and I write about this, found that 41% of Gen Z and millennial men and 52% of Gen Z and millennial women, they perceive marriage as outdated. I mean, those are big numbers, 1%, 52%. And by the way, I want to say this again, they view the primary institution that I'm writing about as outdated, okay? The good news, and I think this is important to say, is that despite this statistic, and this is according to a 2025 Barna Group study, which I found interesting, about 80% of Gen Z, and about 75% of millennials say they hope to get married. So there is this very important disjunction between large percentages of young people who say it's an outdated institution, who are also saying aspirationally, perhaps one day I would like to get married. And I think that we as a country and as a culture need to internalize this disjunction. We have a very large number of 18, say, to 35, 30 or 35-year-old Americans, men and women, who are quite profoundly confused about what is marriage. How do you define this? Why is it important? I'm reminded of George Orwell, who said that the first duty of an intelligent person is to restate the obvious. And I have learned in my time, and especially in the academic year, in behalf of Focus on the Family, speaking routinely on college campuses, I'm always reminded that even when I am on conservative campuses, but very often I'm on the opposite, that I have to assume that to large percentages of young people, definitively, I may be using terms that in their own mind do not equate with what an otherwise large percentage of baby boom and older Americans, by the way, left and right, perceive these institutions to be.
How come you think that is? I mean, what happened to create that dichotomy?
I think culture is king. I mentioned Pat Moynihan earlier, and in a talk I was giving very recently in Northern Virginia, I was asked a similar question. And I said to my interlocutor the following. I said, Pat Moynihan, I think, was on to something when he said that the principal difference or distinction between conservatives and progressives is that conservatives believe that if you want to impact the course of America, conservatives by and large do believe that you have to impact culture. And he said this disjunction is that progressives, they believe principally you have to impact politics first. So this idea of culture versus politics, as a conservative in good standing, I agree and accord categorically with the late Pat Moynihan. And I believe that we have to look not just for solutions in culture, and I write about that a lot, as you know, but I think we also have to go to culture to understand the absolute weight and destructive nature of what much of American culture and Western culture has done, and the way that it's shaped and formed and impacted all of us, but especially young people. Movies, films, social media, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I'm not a crankshaft and I don't want to do a screed, but I think it is important to say objectively that the weight of the aggressive secularization of culture and its impact on the rising generation of young Americans is very substantial, and especially on the institutions that we're talking about.
You write that the family, using the old maxim, a family that prays together stays together.
Yes.
But you're not saying with that chapter or that essay that if you're not a family of faith, that you can't have a happy marriage, are you?
Absolutely not. And in fact, that would be impossible to assert, because the most reliable research has lots of great things to say about marriages that are rooted, even broadly speaking, religiously or in a faith-based context. But empirical research also shows, and especially for affluent and educated Americans beyond high school, that very often those marriages do very well too. I wish I would have written a bit more about a book that deserves enormous attention, and that book by Charles Murray called Coming Apart. It's that book really, I think, is one of the most important books of the last 25 years regarding the issue of marriage, family, and parenting. And a very, very fleet summary is that Charles is saying that affluent, educated people tend to get married and stay married. They tend to have their children inside of marriage. They tend to have a very consistent, stable, both work and kind of faith life that is a lifeblood and nourishing to the success of their marriage. But Charles shows, and he does this, by the way, overwhelmingly among Americans who are white, coming apart specifically looked at, and I'm not using the phrase inaccurately, but Americans who are white and not black or Hispanic or another ethnicity. But he specifically delves into the data, among white Americans. And he found, and I think this is very important to say, that for Americans who were not educated beyond high school, that for the same exact matrices, it's a very difficult situation. If a couple decide in this particular demographic to get married, they very often predictably get divorced. If they decide to have children, predictably, very often, those children are born out of wedlock. It's a very discontinuous, often, work pattern, and it's a very discontinuous faith pattern. What you and I used to call the salt of the earth was common, whether you were the wealthiest family in town, or you were a working class family. Marriage rates and children inside of marriage rates tended to be quite contiguous up to and including the late 1960s. So the sheer weight of culture, I think, has dramatically impacted not just marriage, but the idea of family as well.
So do we have a loneliness crisis?
We have a massive loneliness crisis. And I thought it was very important to devote an entire chapter in What Really Matters to what I simply call restoring the American male. And I'll say here too, Wesley, this is a part of the book that has gotten a lot of attention, and I pray for a good reason, because this is a demographic, young American men, 18 to 30, where it's very difficult to determine what is actually going on. It's actually very difficult to say that there's the kind of consistency that we've been able to speak about among young American men in other epochs of American history. Men now account for 3 out of every 4 suicides or drug overdoses, and approximately 15% of American men say they have no friends. That's a loneliness crisis. In fact, it's quite substantial. But I'll say in this same demographic, 18 to 25-year-old men tell reliable sources that faith and religion have become more important to them. More of them are going back to church. We know of reliable studies that show of substantial conversions, even in otherwise blue urban areas. These young people also say, these young men say, they want to be married. They want to have children. They want to be a part of a kind of a, what you and I call a stable religious and faith-based, a community. But the challenge is that in this same demographic, Wesley, same demographic, there are millions of other young men who are not working, not looking for a job, not in school, not applying to be in school. Our common friend Nick Eberstadt at the American Enterprise Institute has done rather remarkable research, and in part, not whole, but in part, it explains why these otherwise unmarriageable men, or often unmarriageable men, are very often discounted by women in the same demographic who say aspirationally they want to be married. They want to have children, but whether you're progressive or conservative, women in that demographic are saying if they want to proceed with marriage, they're looking for an economic partner, a husband who has reliability economically, and if they have children, will be a great father. So this chasm between men and women is quite enormous. We have very recent studies, as recently as the last few months, that show that the demographic for employment for men over against employment for women relative to the two is decreasing among men. And this is quite substantial. At the same time that we have a birth dearth. We have the lowest marriage and fertility rates in American history. This crosses over with the restoration of American men and women.
I want to get into the masculinity issue, but I had one more question on marriage, and it's something of a challenge for you.
Yes.
You write that marriage is a key to a happy life, and that a happy life is a connected life.
Yes.
Yet you oppose same-sex marriage and So I guess I'm asking, how are the two views of opposing same-sex marriage and saying, you know, having a connected marriage is a key to a happy life? How are those compatible? Are gay people just to be lonely, or how do you reconcile those two positions?
Yeah, I'm actually honored by that question. And I am always very eager up front to say that as a biblical Christian, I believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. And I do not believe as a biblical Christian that I can redefine that institution. I have to be able to support the institution that God gave us of opposite sex marriage. So I think, and we at Focus on the Family believe that as well, and we believe it very strongly. So I think it's very important in light of what really matters, that when a reader goes into my book, he or she understands that I absolutely come with that worldview. And I think that's important, not just in a book of this nature. I think it's true of history or theology or whatever. I mean, it's a large, complex continental nation. We all have different ideas about the biggest thing. And I think what's most important is not that we disagree. We're going to disagree on the biggest things there are. But what I think is important, in fact, I think it's morally incumbent upon all writers to be able to say up front that this is my worldview, that I come to these issues from that worldview. If I'm reading David McCullough as a historian, if I'm reading Arthur Schlesinger Jr. as a historian, if I'm reading James McGregor Burns as a historian, I have a strong sense immediately up front that they bring a particular worldview to the way that they write. I got to know Arthur at the very end of his life. He was a very upfront Kennedy-era progressive. And in his great Age of Jackson, his great work on Franklin Roosevelt and on John Kennedy himself, Arthur was very upfront about his worldview and what he brought to bear upon his view of American and world history. David McCullough was the same. The late Paul Johnson, a very extraordinary Anglo, a British historian, conservative, and upfront about the way that he, as a British conservative, perceived the course of history, especially the 18th, 19th, 20th century that he wrote about so brilliantly. So I'm quite comfortable that people who do not share my view of marriage, who are very excellent people, that they also bring a worldview and a vision to the way that they look at research and choose to synthesize and write about it.
But what does that do for gay people who don't want to be lonely, who want to live a connected life, as you've described, and if they don't have access to that institution?
Well, the thing is, in 21st century America, they do. And we can disagree about Bostock, and we can disagree about the definition of marriage or a family. But, you know, may I say, even though I disagree with that view, I don't want to be disagreeable, and I don't want to ever be uncivil or lacking magnanimity or grace. And I say with utter humility, some of my great friends and comrades are people on a host of issues, including these, where we choose to disagree on the biggest things there are, but to disagree agreeably and civilly. And frankly, I love that about this extraordinary country, that we can disagree about the biggest things there are, and even the things that I write about. You know, I think I pray with great conviction in what really matters. But my friends and comrades are just as important to me, whether they agree or whether they disagree. And I think we're better for it, by the way. I think we're better for it to enter into the kind of dialogue, conversation, and discussion. I think that is one of the things that Americans right and left of goodwill have found so troubling about the era of DEI, Wokistan, and this sort of thing, that somehow we can't sit down and have a robust discussion on big things and just choose to disagree, but with a amiable sense of we're going to leave the conversation at that.
And of course, as you said in the beginning, based on your college experience, when you have those kinds of discussions, sometimes that opens up a whole new thought process in yourself, because, you know, it's not just about this is my position, well, this is my position. it's a conversation, it's a dialogue, and that often can change people's perspective.
I'm glad you raised that, and I mean what I'm saying, that some of my very dearest and closest friends, and dearest and closest friends to our family, are people who have a profoundly different worldview. And I remember a number of years ago being at a rather large dinner, and a person who did not know any of us essentially made a comment that we all still kind of laugh about, saying that you just all choose to disagree and not discuss these things. And we said, no, it's just the opposite. We choose to agree that we are going to disagree, and we love to be able to engage and hear the other side. And I'm not being clever by that. I think it's very important to be heard and to be listened to. But I think many ways, Wesley, it's more important to hear and to listen and to really absorb what somebody else has to say. I remember as a boy, reading a very famous, maybe one of the most famous novels ever written, in which Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird, and I think this is important both in the novel and in the film, where he reminds his daughter, Scout, that it's very important, to sort of get inside someone else's skin, that they don't bring to bear upon every, a chapter in our own lives the same experiences, the same people, the same perceptions. And that's not to say there's not objective truth. I believe very strongly that there is objective truth. I'm not a moral relativist. I reject nihilism. And I think that those, in my view, bad ideas have contributed profoundly to what Pope Benedict XVI rightfully talked about when he used that powerful phrase, the dictatorship of moral relativism. I think it's been a real difficult reality in the culture in which we find ourselves.
I think the Atticus Finch character, I was once asked, if you could be any fictional character in his, that's ever been written about, who would it be? And I said, Atticus Finch, because yes. I think first he was an attorney, I'm a lawyer. But secondly, I think he epitomized the virtues of masculinity, which you're discussing. And that brings up a question. How do you define masculinity?
Yeah. May I say, really, whether as a man of the right and as a traditionalist, no doubt about that. But I can honestly say, apart from any ideology, I never thought that anybody would attend a presidential inaugural or watch an inaugural and have a president say that it's the official policy of the United States that we have two sexes, male and female. And the answer is we do have two sexes, and it's male and female. And my view is that you know this from the book and the chapter that I do. I believe that we objectively can say this is masculinity and this is femininity. But I'm also comfortable, Wesley, that for purposes of this book, that I did not principally write this book so that I could do a deep dive into what has already become a massive cultural and public debate on the profound or deep meanings, of these or other words. In other words, I do not want, by debating those things, to obscure from my larger purpose or mission in writing, especially the chapter on restoring the American male. I objectively wanted to look at American males of every age and to say, how are we doing? How are American men doing over against a more biological or gender-based debate per se.
Do you think that in the last 50 years or so, there's been too much emphasis put on promoting the opportunities for women?
By the way, I love that question. And the answer is, I, looking back, think that I could have attempted an additional chapter in this book, which is that while I write a chapter restoring the American male, I did not write a chapter, restoring the American female. And I think that in retrospect, I think I should have done that because, and I want to be specific in answering you, if I may, as you know, in the book, went back and looked very specifically, not as a full chapter or writing with the same depth of for American men. But I did want to look at some of the similar statistics for young American women. And I'll tell you, I was very shaken by much of what I read. And it's one of the areas that I intend to do more research in and to have a better handle or grasp on. And I'd like to demonstrate what I mean by that, which is that, as you know, I write in What Really Matters about the suicide and self-harm rates for adolescents, particularly girls. And that number, this is really something, has quadrupled from 2010, which of course was the start of the smartphone era, just to 2021. So just in those few years, 11 years, to internalize the fact that suicide and self-harm for these adolescents has quadrupled is even beyond sobering, if I may say. To ring the bell backwards, about 60% of American girls and about 30% of American boys report persistent feelings of loneliness. And I do write about the loneliness crisis. I write about the dating recession. These are not just loose or flip terms. They are really deeply felt and lived experiences by millions of American boys and girls and young men and young women. So that to me is of particular concern as we discuss what really matters in America. These are really,
and I think you're right, a very serious problems. Are they primarily a factor of the online social media screens and this kind of thing?
Yes, I think so. And by the way, you didn't ask me this question, but I want to pick up on that because you asked me something earlier that I think fits kind of as the last piece in the jigsaw puzzle. You may know, and I'm going to be writing about it very soon. You may know, Wesley, that we have the first studies of what is the impact of removing cell phones, and there were a number of people who said, well, one of the obvious things is going to be that we're going to see a greater levels of literacy, greater levels of higher achievement in math, reading, etc. And the first studies do not indicate that. And I'm not completely surprised, but I'm kind of surprised because in What Really Matters, I, as you know, devote an entire chapter titled Restoring the Importance of History. And the reason I did that, I've written a whole book about the moral and cultural case for teaching the great American story in my book, Toward a More Perfect Union. But I wanted to deepen it. I wanted to look at more recent statistics and kind of rethink a part of what I wrote about, which is the kind of historical and cultural illiteracy in our nation. What I found that is so genuinely sobering is that only about 13%, and maybe I'm grading on a curve, but only 13% of American eighth graders are deemed proficient in American history. 13%. New York City every fiscal year spends tens of billions of dollars for its under 1 million public school students. I mean, this is really stunning. And just as one example, the numbers are going backwards. So I don't have a great hope that merely removing cell phones is somehow going to address this issue. But overall, and not to lose the point, we've got, and especially in our 250th year, we've simply got to address the idea and have a renewed, stained, I believe, commitment to the importance of restoring the teaching of history. I think it's that important.
Yeah, I think we've got a real crisis in pedagogy, too, in the sense that these kinds of things that you and I were taught is basically part of our education are not being taught anymore, and other things are replacing them. But we're running out of time, and I want to get just a few more points in because I appreciate the effort you've given to give us this time.
Thank you. Your fifth
chapter is entitled Restoring Faith. Are you talking about traditional Christianity specifically or a general sense of belief in a higher power?
I am a traditional biblical Christian and I have a personal interest and I like to think stake in that. I am one of the vice presidents at Focus on the Family and et cetera, et cetera. But for purposes of this book, Wesley, all cards on the table, because most empirical data sets that I write about and pay attention to typically are more broadly defined, not always, but often. then I thought it was better than, since I'm not an original researcher myself, I thought it was better to pay attention to the historic modeling of how reputable companies and surveys study these things. So, for instance, in my chapter, Restoring Faith, I write broadly about, about one third of U.S. adults say they attend religious services in person at least once a month, which relative to the rest of the Western world is pretty gigantic. But 25% who report going at least once a week, compared to 70% of those numbers in the 50s and the 60s. So it's a giant downward trend, but only compared to American numbers. When you look across the West, we remain a country of a large percentage, relatively speaking, of Americans who go to church regularly, and a very substantial number who still attend once a week. So I'm speaking broadly of all faith categories, because that's what's measured. However, as you know, I take plenty of time to look at Christians, specifically biblical Christians. I take the opportunity to study the surveys, if it's good data, from researchers who are particularly interested in American evangelicals or otherwise defined conservative Christians, weekly mass attending or regular mass attending Catholics. It's a big country. You can't always accurately capture all the numbers. But I do my best in a good faith effort in restoring American faith to look more broadly at American religion and faith.
You know, we can't force people to believe. Do you think that we can cure what ails us if people do not have faith?
You know, I think it would be pretty impossible to understand the American Republic from even before we were a country became a country in 1776. I mean, there was a large presence, of course, in the American pre-founding and the role of the church. So I would say that America overwhelmingly was founded by dissenting Protestants. I would say overwhelmingly that the impact of the Holy Bible on the founding of America, these are pretty indisputable. My wonderful friend and perhaps yours, Daniel Driesbach, retired now from American University, who's done absolutely path-breaking research on the impact of the Bible on the founding and the importance of the Bible in the entire American experience, so left, right, and center. I think pretty much that religious liberty, conscience rights, the idea of the Judeo-Christian faith historically, now more pluralistic, I think it would be impossible to understand the history, the culture, and the trajectory of where we're going in America apart from faith and religion. In fact, I think it would be a fool's errand. And I think we're actually honor-bound to teach the rising generation of young Americans not only the American story, but why the Bible has been so important and continues to be important in many facets of American culture.
I want to be respectful of your time, but I do have one more question.
Yes, please.
I think a skeptic of your work might say that, taken as a whole, you're saying that we basically need to return to the 90s only without the racism. What would you think about that?
Yeah, I would say that is a bad interpretation of the narrative of this book or of my work. But I could fully understand why someone could come to that conclusion because of the bona fides that I bring to it as an author. I mean, I am a conservative and I am a biblical Christian and I'm a traditionalist, and in my life have worked for one conservative U.S. Senator, Dan Coats of Indiana, and one conservative president, George W. Bush, for almost 8 years in the presidency and nearly 10 years in the Senate, and the last 18 as one of the vice presidents that focus on the family. So for the second time in one great discussion, there are all my cards on the table. So I do bring absolutely that worldview. And may I say, civilly but unapologetically, it's what I bring to the table, because that's who I am. But I would say this. I would say that a very important question is, what kind of a country do we want 50 years from now, much less 250? I think, for the reasons of what really matters and the things that I've written about, Wesley, I think it's important to absolutely say with great certainty that marriage orients men and women toward the future. Pat Moynihan, I think, made this point brilliantly. Because whether they are Christians or not, marriage asks them not just to commit to each other, but it asks them to plan and to earn and to save and to devote themselves to advancing their children's prospects. And I think that that's a really beautiful way to build a life. I mentioned Jim Wilson earlier that it's not money, but the family that is the foundation of public life. And in marriage, means something. Having children in marriage means something. And I think a complete overhaul of society will not happen overnight. And I do not believe that advocating for a return to any epoch other than the 21st century is really a very good trajectory. In fact, I think it's mostly whistling in the wind. I think the best days for America are actually in front of us. And it's going to look different than it did in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s. And may I say, I think as a conservative, I think that's a good thing. It's not that I have any illusions about the way we're going to move forward as a country, because we're going to be crossing bridges that we can, I think, close a chasm on. That's why we have bridges. But I think there are going to be other places that we're not going to be able to bridge. Polarity is a reality. And as we become a bigger country in the years ahead, I think we have to accept that. One of my heroes is Whitaker Chambers. He said, you know, to maneuver is life. And we have to maneuver in the time that we're in. And I'm comfortable saying it's going to look different, but it doesn't mean that we cannot reform it in order to preserve it. And I think we are already seeing good things in the major areas that we're talking about.
I think the most important contribution your work provides and this book provides and your previous books is that you are not afraid to step on third rails, if you will, that you bring really crucial and important topics to the forefront that often people shrink from discussing because they're afraid they'll be criticized or they're afraid they'll hurt other people's feelings. And you do it in a way of great graciousness and, if I may, love for those who you disagree with. And I think it's very important because how can we have a discussion and comity as a society and even federalism, which I think is the answer to this, to these conundrums, frankly, it's the only one that we have at the moment with our divisions, if we're so afraid to bring these topics to the forefront. And I admire you for your courage, and I thank you for being on the program.
Those are really gracious words from you, my friend, and I appreciate it more than I can say. And this might be a nice note to close on. One of my great heroes is John Adams. I think he was a pugnacious, gritty Yankee. And what incredible graciousness he showed in saying to Tom Jefferson, you know, you ought to be the one to write the Declaration because maybe I'm a bit too controversial. And the reason I mentioned this, Wesley, is for the reason you probably know where I'm going. They had a remarkable friendship, Jefferson and Adams, but they disagreed on the biggest things it is possible to disagree on. And even despite their differences, one from the top of the Virginia Regency and one from a self-made Massachusetts nonconformist in many ways. They found a way forward to create the United States of America. And over the French Revolution, they had a terrible, terrible estrangement. Their friendship was broken in 500 pieces. It was an acrimonious run for the White House. Adams didn't even stay to go to Jefferson's swearing in. I mean, it was as acrimonious as it could have been. And yet a common friend of theirs, one of the most prominent Christians in the founding, Dr. Benjamin Rush, brought them back together. He re-sewed together this friendship. And they ended up dying on the same day, July 4th, many, many years later. The reason I share this, with no revisionism whatsoever, is that if two men of this standing, two patriots, two Americans of this standing, could bridge a divide on the biggest things there were, and they did, agreeing to disagree on really big things, then it seems to me in 21st century America and forward, we can do the same thing. And if I have contributed to that at any level, praise God. I hope that I have, because the country is worthy of our esteem.
Yeah, they both died on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration, and Adams' last words were, "And Jefferson lives," except Jefferson had already died.
Exactly right. Exactly right. It was the idea of time and the sands of time and the mails, in that time, and we couldn't have known until the family couldn't have known till many weeks later.
Well, Tim, thank you for being on the program, for taking the time to write this book and put it together, and for all of your work. We'll talk to you again.
Be of good cheer. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.